Hi, this is Marion Nessel. I'm the Paulette Goddard Professor of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University and a longtime fan of Heritage Radio.
Like Marion, you too can support Heritage Radio Network, a member-based nonprofit radio station operating out of Bushwick, Brooklyn.
I've been on it countless times. I love being interviewed. The interviewers are always really well prepared and fun to talk to about the issues that matter to me the most, about how we can change our food system to one that's healthier for people and the environment. It's just invaluable to have an independent radio station that's dealing with these issues. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful asset.
Support Heritage Radio Network by becoming a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate.
The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew is proudly sponsored by Restaurant Owner App. Restaurant Owner App is a free app designed by a restaurateur for restaurateurs. Visit restaurantownerapp.com for more.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew, where we serve a weekly menu of industry commentary based on what the market has to offer. I'm Andrew Friedman from Tokeland.com.
I'm Jimmy Bradley from The Red Cat.
Chef Curtis Stone, who 2 years ago opened Maud in Beverly Hills, launched his new restaurant Gwen earlier this week. The ambitious restaurant serves a five-course tasting menu featuring plated and shared dishes, highlighted by charcuterie and meats from Gwen's own European-style butcher shop. We're pleased to welcome, from Los Angeles, Chef Curtis Stone. Good morning, Curtis.
Good morning. How you doing?
We're good. You sound
excellent.
Amazingly energetic for someone who just completed, if we're not mistaken, your second night of service a few hours ago.
Yeah, I was here until 2 o'clock in the morning closing down, and I'm back here to light the fires again this morning.
Wow. And
we
for
really
people,
appreciate it.
For people who are not listening live, it's this show is happening at 8 a.m. Pacific time. So, as Jimmy just said, we really appreciate you coming on during this week and at this early hour. You know, the first question we always like to ask chefs who just opened a restaurant is, you know, the most basic one, but how's it going? How have your first two nights been, and how are you coming out of the gate?
Look, it's always a really bizarre feeling when you open a restaurant because you sort of, it's like this race against time to finish the build. You've got sort of, you know, anywhere up to 50 construction people in a space, you know, firing away, trying to build the place. And at some point you have to commit to a time that you are actually swinging the doors open and welcoming guests. So you do, of course, a little friends and family and have the special people in your world come in and the ones that will give you the honest feedback. So we did that for a week, and we've had two nights of guests through. It's been a full house the first couple of nights, which is super exciting to any chef that opens a restaurant. And, you know, of course, there's little kinks for us to work through, but so far, so good.
Great. Can you, for our listeners, just describe, in your own words, what the concept of the restaurant is? I mean, obviously, as it's been explained through the media, the heart of Gwen, which I take it is named for one of your grandmothers, is this European-style butcher shop, which actually slightly predates the restaurant itself. And the understanding is that this kind of grew out of a sort of love for that style of butcher shop and a butchery itself that you and your brother Luke, who's doing the project with you, share, and also that you developed working for Marco Pierre White.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, my brother and I both actually started our careers in butcher shops, and we've always had a real fondness for that old school craft that butchers bring to great meat. You know, there's three things that make meat taste delicious. It's the first, I call it the three stages. The first stage is how the animal's bred and fed. So the breed's very important, and so is, you know, what the animal's fed on. And then of course, the butchering process from point of slaughter to, you know, point of sale, I guess, is the second part where you sort of, you know, you can hang meat for a certain amount of time. You can tender stretch it or you can hang it from its Achilles. So that will change the way it eats. You know, we are serving a bone-in ribeye that's 80 days old. So, you know, that's a much longer period of time than you would normally find in your meat stores. And then, of course, the last process is how you cook it, you know, how the chef actually treats the animals. So we've tried to sort of figure out those three compartments separately and really hone in on how the animals are bred and fed, and then, of course, how we age. We have a dry age room in-house here that, of course, serves the butcher shop but also our restaurant. And then we're cooking everything over fire. So we're cooking almond, we're burning almond wood, and we're grilling. We've got a big fire pit, which is an assador, so we're roasting whole animals as well. So we're, you know, I guess that's it. That's it in its simplest form. You know, the restaurant itself is, you know, a total departure from a butcher shop in some ways, because what I'm trying to do is mix fine dining with, you know, this old school European craft of butchery. And, it's a really interesting dynamic, because you've got the skill of the butcher and the skill of the chefs sort of somehow coming together and, you know, taking something that you would imagine when you say butcher shop and restaurant, you sort of think of these big chunks of meat really simply cooked and, you know, some side dishes that go out. We are doing some of that, but we're also bringing some real elegance and sort of find, you know, if anybody's come and dined at Maud, I guess you'd sort of understand there. We do a 10 or 12 course degustation style tasting menu, and so there's elements of that, but there's sort of almost elements of this very delicious, simple cooking as well.
Has this concept or some version of this concept been in your mind or your mind and your brother's mind for a long time? How did this thing sort of gestate and come to its current real life form?
Look, there's certain butcher shops that just stand out around the world, and there's one in Sydney called Victor Churchill that has always impressed me. It's owned by a meat distributor, and they do, you know, it's like this meat boutique. It's like, you know, my wife likes to go and shop in high-end fashion, you know, stores and buy handbags. I like to do the same thing, but I like to come home with a ribeye. And, you know, there's one in London in Mayfair, a place called Allen's, that when I moved to London, I was just so taken aback by the quality and craft that they put into their meat. So there's certain inspiration, I guess, from the butcher shop, and then, you know, how you sort of turn that into something really elevated was always my goal. You know, I think when I started Maud, you know, farm to table has been around in LA forever, and effectively it's great shopping and simple cooking. You know, you take great ingredients, you treat it as simply as you can, and show off the integrity of the ingredient. And with Maud, I wanted to flip that on its head and say, let's take that perfect ingredient and put it under a microscope and actually see what we can do with it. You know, what are all the elements? Can we turn it into a snow? Can we turn it into a foam? Can we dehydrate it? Can we crisp it? Can we poach it, roast it, fry it? You know, so we go through and say, can you eat the leaves? Can you eat the seeds? You know, so we sort of really break down that ingredient and try and show a different level of elevated cooking with it. And I guess a similar approach applies to, you know, fantastic quality meat and game and poultry and game, you know, different birds, where we sort of take that one ingredient and say, how can we, you know, through the years of knowledge that my team and I have had, you know, working in great restaurants, sort of turn that into really an unforgettable experience.
You used the F phrase a minute ago. You said fine dining. It's kind of an interesting topic these days. We've talked about it on the show. And I want to preface the question by saying that I think Jimmy feels the same way that I do, that L.A. is probably, for me, it's my favorite city. It's my favorite city in the country to visit and eat in. I think historically it's been very underrated, but it's you know, it's sort of associated with a more casual style of dining. And, you know, there's no Michelin guide anymore in Los Angeles. And I'm just wondering, and this question, I guess, goes back to when you first, you know, did Maud, was there a hesitancy to put forth a restaurant and now a second restaurant, you know, that one would categorize as a fine dining restaurant with a tasting menu. In that city in particular, did you have any concern about it being a hard sell in Los Angeles?
Yeah, I think I turned away from every piece of advice that I was ever given in L.A., and you know, we broke every rule that there was to break. You know, you sort of, when you do think of L.A., you think of the most incredible Korean food and the best sushi you've ever eaten and the best tacos and Mexican food. And, you know, there's this very casual and then incredible farm to table because, of course, the city has, you know, the best produce that I've come across in the world anyway. And that's sort of the obvious thing to do. But to me, it always was sort of glaringly obvious that we're here in a giant city. There's 8 million people here. There's plenty of wealth like there are in other cities that have these world-class restaurants, whether it be San Francisco, Chicago, New York. There's a variety of restaurants that you can go and have a really elevated experience, whether you brand it as fine dining or not. And truthfully, fine dining is a word I hate because it's one of those things that conjures up fussiness, you know, the thoughts of, you know, a waiter dressed in a monkey suit sort of looking down their nose at you. And, you know, what I wanted to create was an LA version of fine dining, which was sort of, I call it fine dining without the fluff. You know, we have the knowledge. If you want to talk to us about the vintages of Bordeaux, we've got someone in-house that will stand there and talk to you about it for 10 minutes. But we certainly don't force that on anybody. And, you know, I think that we're in the entertainment business, right? We're entertaining people through dining. And what I think is really important is you never forget that your guest experience is theirs. It's not yours. And you sort of tailor make it for what they want, you know? So of course you'll have some people that come in and they want all that romance of the story of where the ingredients come from and the wines they're drinking, but they'll also be another guest in a different part of the room that's, you know, into the conversation that they're having with their guests, whether it be a business conversation or a personal one, and they want to be more left alone. So we try and read our guests as much as we can and sort of tailor make the experience for them.
What about from the other side of the equation, from the staffing side? When you first did Maud in Los Angeles, did you, in terms of the talent that you were looking for, both front and back of the house, was there a pool of people available to you in that city who wanted, you know, to cook in that style, who sort of had the, no pun intended, had the chops to cook in the style that you're putting forth in these restaurants? Did you have to bring talent in from elsewhere? Were there people, you know, with the front of house sort of finesse that you would expect in a restaurant of this ambition? I'm just wondering, I love Los Angeles, but I don't associate a certain level of formality or a certain style necessarily with the city. And I'm just wondering if you initially had to, you know, bring people in from elsewhere.
Look, it's a catch 22 because you've got, of course, way less talent in LA historically when it comes to those fine, you know, those high-end restaurants. If you open a restaurant in New York and you're looking for a brigade of people that have worked in, you know, world-class Michelin-starred restaurants, there's 20 other restaurants that you'd be happy to accept line cooks from because they come in and they say, oh, I worked at Per Se or I worked at 11 Madison Park or wherever, and you sort of think to yourself, okay, you clearly know what you're doing, you know, to make it in that kitchen, you'll be in good stead here. In Los Angeles, you don't have that. You know, there's probably two or three restaurants that people come in and that's on their resume. There's Melisse and Providence and even Tuamek.
Right.
You know, so there's a handful of them, but of course, the pool is so much smaller because there's only so many of those guys going around looking for a job. So, you know, we actually, you advertised it and brought people. You know, I had people that I'd worked with in London that came over. I had people from Australia that I'd worked with that came over. And then we advertised in New York and Chicago. So, you know, the opening crew at Maud had one guy in the kitchen from LA, and the rest had come from New York and Chicago, one from San Francisco, one from Colombia,
right.
A couple of Aussies and a couple of Brits. And, you know, I think, you know, and I don't want to talk poorly of Los Angeles at all. It's an incredible...
Oh yeah, and I hope it's clear. I didn't mean it that way at all. It just seems what you're doing was a little different, I guess I would say. You know, people talk. You use the word historically, and I think people historically would say that a lot of people who come up on in the West Coast in general over in the years in the past you know, what a lot of people say is they're not as sort of technique obsessed. You know, they're not as, you know, you some of the restaurants that you mentioned in other places, there's just a different, it's just a different approach. I don't mean at all to seem derogatory.
Absolutely right. And look, I think in some ways that gives you a different level of freedom. You know, the truth is I would never have opened Maud in Chicago because it is governed by the Michelin Guide, and I spent my entire life working in Michelin rated restaurants. And you know, you work at a one star and that's great, and then you work at a three star and you realize the level there. And then, you know, if you get to open a restaurant, of course, because that's how you've been judged your entire life, you're conscious of it, you know. So the thought of opening a restaurant like Maud, where we change the menu each month and it revolves around one ingredient each month, you think to yourself, well, by its nature, that brings a level of inconsistency that the Michelin Guide wouldn't like, and in some ways is prohibitive of opening a restaurant like that, because, you know, in all clarity, transparency, you're just too nervous to do it. You know, what happens the Michelin guy coming on your first night of a menu and you've still got a few kinks that you're working through and it's not quite there, and your two Michelin star food only gets one star, or even worse, doesn't even get a star because, you know, that very first night of service wasn't quite right. Or, you know, so there's an interesting balance. I'll never forget Marco Pierre White, who I worked for a long time, always saying, you know, three Michelin star restaurants in their essence are sort of perfect, but they're also very boring because, you know, you're forced into this repetition and this sort of, you know, constant elevation of the same thing. Where a two Michelin star, you can be a little bit more creative and you can drive a little hard. You know, you're trying to get to the third, so you've got to do stuff that's different. You've got to do stuff that's more inventive, and you've also got to refine it. You know, and as soon as you take that layer of complexity out of it allows you this sort of creative freedom, I guess, to say, well, you know, let's give it a shot. Let's try something new. And, you know, look, lucky enough at Maud, we've got a really loyal group of regulars that haven't missed a month. They've been to every single menu for 2.5 years. And, you know, they love that change and that newness that you can sort of bring in that way.
You just mentioned Marco Pierre White. You know, if on your website, you in your bio, which is written in the first person, you know, he's still, I mean, someone that you worked for a while ago, occupies a really prominent place in your bio. You talk about White Heat being the first cookbook that you ever owned. You sort of came to London with this on a mission of working for this guy. Can you just speak a little bit to Marco and sort of what his influence on you was and just what it was like? You eventually became head chef of his restaurant, Quo Vadis, and before that you were at Mirabelle. But what was that time in your life like, and what about it stays with you today?
Look, I was 21 when I left Australia and sort of went and traveled throughout Europe for a couple of months and landed in London with the intention of hopefully getting a job with Marco. You know, of course, back in those days, sending an email wasn't so easy because no one used it. and, you know, writing a letter seemed like, you know, he would never read it. So I thought, I'll just show up, you know, I'll walk in the back door and see what happens. And,
right.
At that point, Marco was sort of this infamous chef that seemed to be sort of changing the way food worked. You know, he broke all the rules. He didn't have, you know, this kind of crazy need to do what everyone else had done. But, you know, what I found when I started working for him, and, you know, I started as a commie who my first job was to sweep the floor and pick the salad leaves and pick the herbs and peel the carrots and, you know, like the most simple stuff. And, of course, I was a qualified chef, so pretty humbling. But to watch the speed and the energy in that kitchen, which, of course, was driven by the man himself, was really something else. You know, like he had this determination to be the best and to work harder than anyone had ever worked. And, you know, I mean, if I told you all the stories, it'd take forever. But he, you know, he just had this ability to motivate a team. And, of course, through that old-school way of 100% discipline, you know, like the thought of answering Marco back was just ridiculous. You know, like the way his kitchens worked were, there were new people in them all the time. You know, there was the core group of guys that had sort of been with him from the early days, and then people would come in and try and make it and just find it a little overwhelming. So, you know, there was this constant turnover, and if you made it through the day, you felt like you were handed a medal because you made it through the day. And once you'd made it through a couple of weeks, you thought, my God, I'm doing all right. And 6 months in, you're like, he hasn't fired me yet. It's unbelievable. Right. You know, I'm doing something extraordinary. And, you know, you had this real sense of playing for the winning team. You know, I played Aussie rules football as a kid, and it's the same sort of camaraderie that a close-knit team has when you are in a kitchen and you do spend 16 or 17 hours a day in a kitchen like that with one another. And it's work and nothing else. You know, you don't really have much of another you don't have any other life, truthfully. You get the bus home and fall asleep, and you get up and you go straight back to work. You know, that's sort of what it is.
Yeah. And this is, I assume this is, I mean, do you find yourself, it sounds like you really sort of absorb those lessons. Are these things that you find yourself imparting to the people who cook with you today? I mean, this is obviously was someone who was a huge influence on you.
Yeah, look, I mean, I worked for him. You earn nothing. You work your butt off. You walk out of it with an education. You know, it's in some ways, you think about going to college, and you've got to pay for that privilege. And in this instance, you actually get paid to learn. So, you know, people always say, "How did you handle it?" Or how, you know, was it as tough as everybody says? Well, yeah, it was tougher than everybody thinks. You know, he was crazier than everybody assumes. But that was a part of it. And you know, I think that I say the same thing when I sit down with my guys. I'm like, "What do you want from this industry? You know, do you want a good life? Do you, you know, do you want easy hours? Do you want to earn a lot of money? Do you want an education? You know, tell me what you want, and I can point you in the right direction. It might be here, but it might not be. You know, if you want to come and work in one of our restaurants, then yeah, we really knuckle down and we all sort of band together as a group and work really hard. But we come out of it really strong, which I think, you know, I've got amazing relationships with people that I've worked with for many years, and it wasn't always easy, but it's you know, you're happy at the end of the day, I guess.
Yeah. What's your own leadership style with your crew?
Look, we've got, it's totally different to how Marco led his team, that's for sure. You know, I'm certainly not a yeller or a screamer, and those days have changed drastically anyway. I mean, we stand in an open kitchen, so there's absolutely no way he could behave like Marco used to. We were hidden in the back, so that was, I guess, a benefit of that strategy. But, you know, I try and empower my guys as much as I possibly can. I get everybody involved in the development. The truth is, I've been really blessed. You know, I've got to work with some super talented guys. I've got Gareth Evans here with me at Gwen. He helped me open Maud. I've got a guy named Justin Hilbert who was from New York and came down, and he's now sort of manning the stoves at Maud. And, you know, they're both super creative, very driven. You know, they bring a world of experience with them from, you know, great restaurants from around the world. And, you know, they sort of, that's what is so special about our industry. It's, you never stop learning. I learn something every single day, and that's sort of my attitude. I want everybody to learn. I want everybody to teach. I want everybody to grow as a team. And, you know, I think that if you can create that, you end up with a team that sticks with you. Unfortunately, our business is a little, in my opinion, the restaurant industry doesn't treat itself with the respect it deserves. You know, we don't have the professionalism we need. You know, the vast majority of our industry doesn't supply health insurance for their workers and team, and I think it's wrong. You know, I think that the old tip system is an outdated system, and I think that, you know, it doesn't cater for it makes for a very transient industry, and I don't think that's what we should be. I think we should be a team. We deserve the professionalism that we put into it. We work so hard at our craft, and I think we deserve to. Our team deserves to be treated with respect and dignity.
That's great. In terms of Gwen, what's the main? What would you really love people to know about this new restaurant? How do you see it maybe evolving? As I mean, you're only 2 days out of the gate, but what's sort of your hope for this place?
Look, I think what we've tried to create, we're in the middle of Hollywood, which is a really interesting area. You know, it's sort of still got this real grit to it, which I kind of love. You know, we've been building this place and, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've been here at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning putting up light fixtures or doing stuff. And, you know, a crazy person walks through the front door and it's, the start is pretty disconcerting. But eventually I'd just have a chat with them. Occasionally I'd make them a coffee. And, you know, it's sort of, it's an area that has a really rich history, you know, and what I guess we've tried to do is bring back a little bit of that old Hollywood right back to the heart of it. So we've, you know, we've designed this beautiful space. It's a lot of fun. You know, we don't want to take ourselves too seriously, but we do want the product to be great. You know, we want people to walk out of here saying, that's the best meal I've eaten in a long time. And, you know, I guess that combination of great attentive service and delicious food and, you know, something a little new. I mean, you're sitting right in the middle of the dining room and there's a 40-foot dry-age refrigerator with all sorts of whole ducks and whole lambs and whole hogs and beautiful pieces of dry-age meat. And we're making all our own charcuterie in there, so there's all sorts of different capicolas and prosciuttos and salamis sort of hanging that you get to sample throughout the evening. So it's sort of, I mean, it's more than anything, I want people to come here and have fun, and I hope we serve them something delicious while they're here.
Great. And I should have said this at the top of the show, but I was at you did a little preview dinner at Savoir Magazine a few weeks ago, which I had the privilege of being at. So I sampled at least a prototype of the food, and it was, I have to say, it was fantastic. And can't wait to try the restaurant next time I'm on your side of the country there.
Thanks so much. We look forward to cooking for you. I can't wait.
Thank you. You sound very happy, Chef.
Yeah, I am. You know, you sort of, you walk into every day with this trepidation of what's going to go wrong. You know, I came in, the bathrooms looked pretty put together. On Friday night last week, we're doing friends and family. I came back in Saturday morning and there's builders in there. They'd sanded all the paint off. They'd taken all the fixtures off the doors because they put them on wrong the first time. You're like, what have you done to my bathrooms? They looked good yesterday. They're a disaster. So you sort of, you know, you walk through that. And then, of course, you know, we're, like I mentioned before, we're cooking on this Asador, which is brand new for most of the team. And, you know, it's sort of, we're still learning our way through it. But, you know, at the end of our first few nights, at least, I'm walking out of here with a big smile on my face because people are loving it. So let's hope that continues.
Well, it's palpable from here. We've been talking with Chef Curtis Stone in Los Angeles. His restaurants are Maud and Gwen, which just opened 2 nights ago. Visit them if you can when you're in the City of Angels. Chef, thank you so much, especially for doing it at this hour during a crazy week. Thank you for joining us, and all the best with Gwen.
Lovely chatting to you. Speak to you soon.
Thank you. We'd like to again thank Curtis Stone for his early call in today from California.
Yeah, and congratulate him.
And congratulate
much
him
luck
on
and
Gwen.
Success.
And we'd like to, as always, thank our sponsor, Restaurant Owner App. You can follow us on Twitter at Chef Podcast, on Facebook at The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew. We'd like to, as always, thank our engineer, David. David, thank you very much, giving me the high five from the booth. And we will be back next week with Chef Peter Hoffman, who's going to do a bit of an exit interview with us, as he will have just shuttered his restaurant here in New York City. And with that, I'm Andrew Friedman.
I'm Jimmy Bradley.
And we'll see you back here on The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.